We'll hear argument now in number 87329, the Florida Star versus BJF. Mr. Roddick, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case challenges the constitutionality of Florida Statute 794.03, which imposes sanctions of a nature never sustained by this Court. 794.03 is a content-based categorical ban on the publication of the name of rape victims in the state of Florida. This statute imposes criminal and implied civil sanctions for the publication of true information, as applied here for the publication of information obtained from the public domain, which was placed there by the government. Several aspects of this statute bear particular mention at the outset. First, the statute applies solely to press publication and to the press's news sources. It does not reach gossip or other non-media forms of communication of the same information. The second, the statute imposes a blanket ban, similar to the statutory approach which this Court rejected in the Boston Globe versus Superior Court case. The statute makes no exceptions for the circumstances of the crime, the investigation of the crime, the prosecution of the crime, for the existence of prior publicity, for disclosures of the identity of victims in court, in open court, or for other information that is already in the public domain. Significantly, the statute does not make exception for voluntary disclosures. By the strict terms of the statute, when Florida Senator Paula Hawkins spoke about personal experiences in this area, that was contrary to the statute, and the press reports were as well. It could even be applied to Harvard Law Professor Susan Estrich writing for the Yale Law Journal. As written, the statute is a sanction on pure speech. An analysis applied to a very similar statute in Cox Broadcasting versus Cohn. The sanction on pure speech is underscored by the determination of the Florida First District Court of Appeal, which ruled that the subject matter of my client's publication, newspaper publication, was not to be published as a matter of law. The statute as applied in this case imposes a civil cause of action and imposes negligence per se for publishing, again, truthful information obtained by routine news gathering processes and obtained from the public domain. The implications arising from negligence per se are illustrated by this case. At trial, simply on the proof of publication, the trial judge directed a verdict on liability against the newspaper and sent the case to the jury on damages, including punitive damages, on an instruction of reckless indifference.
But there were some facts in the record before he did that.
Your Honor, those facts were not part of his consideration. The argument,
I just asked you, were there some facts in the record or not?
I'm sorry, there were some facts on the record.
Such as?
There were facts concerning
how the reporter got the information?
There were facts that the reporter got the information in the routine manner. A clerk trainee type reporter was sent down to the sheriff's press room. She transposed information that was available in the press room. It was a press release in an unmanned press room of the sheriff's office of Duval County. That information was in the record.
Wasn't it also that she knew it was the policy of the newspaper not to publish it?
And that
this was not public information?
Your Honor, there was indication that this newspaper indeed has a self-imposed policy of refraining from publishing the name of rape victims in most cases.
And didn't she know that it was contrary to law to publish it?
That was very unclear from the record, Justice White. Mm-hmm. The reporter trainee, and I must emphasize, her sole job was to go down and copy information. She did not write the story. She was not a person who wrote stories.
Is that in the record?
That is in the record, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Her sole job was to go down and copy what the sheriff had set out in the press room, and that's all she did here. There was some testimony about a sign. It wasn't even a sign. It was a photocopy of some statute.
Yes, of course, the suit is against the paper, isn't it?
The suit is against the paper.
Not against her.
It's not against her.
So what happened then? There must have been some facts in the record about what happened at the paper.
The facts in the record are that she put the information copied verbatim from the press released incident report in a bin at the newspaper, and the newspaper reporter, who typically writes up several pages, two or three pages of police report stories, transposed the information into a story.
But there can hardly be claimed that the newspaper didn't know that it was against the law to publish the name.
I think you could probably imply knowledge of the law. There was a very confusing passage of testimony from this clerk trainee type person that there was a photocopy on a bulletin board at the sheriff's office, and it seemed to be a photocopy of a statute. It was not established whether that was placed on the bulletin board before or after the publication.
If the information had been illegally obtained, as if the reporter had gone in and to a private place and obtained it, would you be still making the same as-applied argument? You might be making the overbreadth argument.
If it had been illegally obtained, there would be remedies for theft and for intrusion, and we do not suggest that those remedies should be eviscerated.
Would you still have said that you couldn't be held liable for publishing the name?
We would say that the appropriate sanctions would be to address the manner in which it was illegally obtained.
Well, I know, but would you say that the paper could not be held liable for publishing the name of the rape victim contrary to the law? If the information had been illegally obtained?
If the information had been illegally obtained in the sense that it violated some statutory scheme, that would follow the precedent. That would fit essentially the circumstances.
Can't my question be answered yes or no?
Your Honor, we would contend that there would be a First Amendment right to print information in the hands of the press, mm-hmm. and that the...
Even though it was stolen.
If it was stolen information, the act of theft would be appropriately
punishable. Nevertheless, you say you couldn't be held liable for publishing it.
Your Honor, we...
Even though it hadn't ever been in the public domain.
I'm sorry?
Even though the information had never been in the public domain.
A prohibition against publishing that information would be...
Well, a penalty for publishing, not any prior restraint, just a post hoc penalty for publishing non-public information.
Under the law of Cox Broadcasting versus Cohn and its progeny, this court has suggested that before publication of truthful information can be punished, there has to be a state interest of the highest order, and there should be an evaluation of whether there are less restrictive alternatives. Punishing the act of theft would be a less restrictive alternative. And we contend that truthful publication enjoys a higher level of protection.
Counsel, I don't think this court has ever adopted the rule you propose of absolute freedom to publish true information. What would that rule do to, for example, the tort of publication of private facts?
Your Honor, of course, this is not...
Wipe that out.
This is not the tort of the public
issue
of private facts in this case.
If we were to adopt the rule you ask us to adopt, that would be gone, presumably.
Justice O'Connor, in Smith versus Daily Mail, this court recognized that to punish truthful information requires a state interest of the highest order. And further that...
And is the tort of publication of private facts one of the highest order?
Your Honor, as the tort is presently formulated, it does not have a mechanism either for evaluating whether...
So that would be gone. How about publishing information that would be detrimental to national security during wartime?
Your Honor, that question is not reached by a privacy tort of this nature.
No.
This court has recognized in cases like SNEP that, and going back to Neer versus Minnesota, that... national secrets are matters of concern of the highest order.
What about publishing information in violation of the copyright law?
The distinction between a copyright violation and this is that a copyright violation, such as the Nation case, does not place a restriction on truthful publication. It places a restriction on misappropriating the form of publication.
Well, suppose it's perfectly true. Is that a defense for a newspaper?
there is a distinction between speech and action. And if there was an action of misappropriation, that would escape from a defense of truth. It would be accepted from an defense of truth.
You think there's no high, compelling state interest in protecting a victim of rape from the potential of further physical abuse and physical danger?
The report...
there's evidence that actually, the publication here resulted in some additional trauma for the victim.
There is some evidence of that nature, but Justice O'Connor, as the court noted in Cox Broadcasting versus Cone, the commission of crime is a matter of public concern. In that
but
case,
the identity of the victim might not be, and it put this woman in actual physical danger from potentially from the person who assaulted her before, not an arrest.
The rationale of the Georgia Supreme Court coming up in Cox Broadcasting was that there was no public interest in printing the name of the identity of the rape victim. Cox Broadcasting found broadly that there is a public interest, that this is publication in the public interest, the commission of crime and the prosecution of crime.
What was the legitimate public interest here in publishing the name of this rape victim?
Your Honor, I would have to concede that with respect to this rape victim, my client's own self-imposed policy, if it had been applied, would have excluded that publication. But the court has ruled more broadly on what constitutes public interest. In Rankin versus McPherson and Connick versus Myers, the court talks about public interest in its content and context. All commissions of serious crime and government responses to that crime are matters of public interest. It is a matter of editorial judgment to parse out one aspect of information in the public interest and prohibit that publication.
Does the state have no interest in protecting the physical safety of this crime victim pending the arrest of the assailant?
Absolutely, the state has an interest. And under the decisions of Landmark and Cox Broadcasting versus Cone, the state can achieve that interest by less restrictive means, by better control of information in its hands. Here it is clear. If the information had been properly handled by the Duval County Sheriff's Department, and she did sue the Duval County Sheriff, this problem would not have occurred.
But your position is that even if she'd gone in and stolen the information, the paper still could not be fined for reprinting.
The paper could be fined for the tort of misappropriation.
And you'd say, the state should be more careful and shouldn't permit things to be stolen, right?
Absolutely. That's a much less restrictive alternative than a statute which has a broad categorical prohibition on publication.
Well, but that's not really very satisfying. I mean, let's take the troop sailing example, you know, the classic example of restricting a paper from publishing the date on which a troop ship is going to sail. Under your theory, the government should be very careful not to let that information out. But once it gets out, there's nothing it can do.
Not
as long as it's true.
Not
or
so.
A false state that they published, that would be okay. Then you could stop that.
Justice Scalia, under my theory, there are a couple of observations. First of all, the invasion of privacy tort wouldn't really provide much help in matters of protecting public safety and national security. But what's more, the court has the authority legislatures have the authority to create rules where the state interest is of the highest order, and in cases of national security, troop shipments in time of war, that's recognized as a matter of...
That's what this basically comes down to how important we think it is to prevent a rape victim from being killed by her assailant while he's still out there somewhere. Is that what you want us to decide how important that is?
I must point out that the record does not sustain the implication that the assailant was not brought to justice or was still out there. But in any event, there's no evidence that the statute was designed for that. It's not narrowly tailored to that. And my position is that a statute which broadly prohibits speech, pure speech, categorically is an unconstitutional statute, that there are less restrictive ways to address the problem.
Just one more question on that line. What about the name and address of the only witness to a killing when the killer is still at large? Could a state have a statute prohibiting just that?
Again, there has to be an analysis of the less restrictive alternatives. If you have a situation like that, I would submit that the appropriate place to place the incentives for controlling that information is with the government. This statute, like others the court has considered, is in effect a backstop statute. If the government does not perform its function, you backstop it by a statute which prohibits publication and holds the press strictly liable for its violation. And by a less restrictive analysis, by the landmark analysis, where in the case of publications about judicial qualification commissions, this court has recognized that there was a possibility that the problem could have been eliminated through careful internal procedures.
What's your answer to Justice Kennedy's question? He asked you a question that I think can be answered by yes or no.
I'm sorry, Justice Kennedy, could you rephrase your question?
Can a state enact a statute which prohibits publishing the name of a witness to a murder when the murderer is still at large?
No, because there is a less restrictive alternative, and that would be a content-based statute that would violate principles that editorial judgments are for
That's
others.
A very odd calculus, though, because the harm comes from the wide distribution given by the media. That's the nature of the harm.
It could also be argued that the harm comes from mishandling that information in the hands of government.
You indicated in the case before us when you started your discussion that this statute doesn't apply to gossip or matter which is unknown to the community at large. It only applies to the press.
That's correct.
The problem is that that's the only thing that causes the injury. That's the only thing that caused the invasion of this person's privacy. It's the only thing that caused her trauma.
There's no evidence of what the statutory purpose is. We can engage in conjecture as to what it might be. Assuming that it is the psychological well-being of the plaintiff, certainly gossip in the community would cause the same injury. Going back to the application of this statute to impose negligence per se, it sets up an anomaly when compared to libel law. Had the Florida Star falsely accused or reported that BJF was raped and she filed a suit for libel, under this court's rules, she would have to prove fault and falsity under the recent HEPS decision. This leads to the anomaly that truthful publication, which is presumed to have a far higher value in the marketplace of ideas, is indeed accorded less protection.
Do you think all truthful publications have the same value? And there's some truthful publications that really aren't all that important, such as the name of this person.
Your Honor, as a matter of your question presupposes, or I guess begs, a distinction between matters in public concern and matters that are not of public concern.
I don't have to draw any distinction. I just say some information is more important than other information, and this information isn't terribly important.
Under the holding of Cox Broadcasting versus Cohn, the commission of crime and the prosecution of crime, in essence the government's response to crime, is a matter of public importance. I think that's a holding of this court. Cox Broadcasting Corporation versus Cohn is indistinguishable from the case at bar, with the exception that in Florida there was a negligence per se action and Georgia refused to imply a cause of action from a statute which this court analyzed as being virtually identical to the Florida statute.
In the Georgia case, the matter that was published was used in public proceedings in the judiciary. These were freely circulated in the court.
Your Honor, that was not a distinction that was essential in the Cox Broadcasting case. Cox talked about information in the public domain generally, not just court information. And in Smith versus Daily Mail and Landmark Communications, this court has broadened its protection for truthful publication beyond truthful publication of matters which come up in open court.
Mr. Rader, you say, you know, part of the solution is the government can just be more careful in keeping this information confidential. But that wouldn't stop your newspaper from going out and finding out from one of the bystanders or from the hospital where the woman was taken, who she was, right?
That's correct. And so, under Smith versus Daily Mail, that would be appropriate. Smith versus Daily Mail.
What would be appropriate? You could do that and publish, right?
Routine news gathering is protected.
No matter how much the government tries to keep the name of this woman out of the press, you're saying you have an absolute right to put it in the press.
I'm saying that, and I think this court said that in Smith versus Daily Mail, that routine news gathering of exactly the
So let's forget about there are other ways to protect it. There aren't any other ways to protect it. We can just forget about it.
I would have to disagree. If the paper went out to set out to find this information, that would be a different case than what is presented here.
But not the way you've been arguing it. I'm
arguing against a statute which imposes negligence per se and which categorically prohibits publication. And there may be facts and circumstances. I would presume that there would be if a newspaper deliberately set out to obtain information that made that information newsworthy. There was an identical statute at issue in Smith versus Daily Mail, Justice Scalia, and the court and the identical news gathering process occurred where the newspapers went out, interviewed people, monitored the police band radio, and published the name of a juvenile offender despite a statute with the same form of ban as exists here.
Mr. Roddart, has there ever been a criminal prosecution in this case?
Never in the history of this statute dating back to 1911, and we did not find one in the two other states which maintain a statute of this nature, either Georgia or South Carolina. The evidence of this record shows that there is a broad self-imposed standard by journalism. But a standard of journalism and a standard of law are two different matters.
And adopted from the law.
I would have to be engaging in conjecture off the record, but I believe that's been a standard.
Either way, you're engaging in speculation. Yeah.
Going back to Justice Blackmun's question, one form of analysis which this court has adopted as not being definitive but certainly relevant is to survey the states to see whether the pattern of a particular statute is uniform or unique. As I have mentioned, there are only three states in the country which have a statute like this. Two of those statutes now have been before this court.
Well, the fact is that there has been no criminal prosecution against the Star for this.
I would find it odd if the sheriff of Duval County had chosen to prosecute under these circumstances. By the terms of the statute, he would have had to prosecute himself because he caused or allowed it to be placed in the public domain. I have
well,
to go
not
back.
Not necessarily so if there's a scienter requirement.
Under
Is there a scienter requirement in this statute?
It's not stated, but there may be under general criminal.
And if there
principles.
Is, then he doesn't have to prosecute himself.
I must return to Cox Broadcasting versus Cone. That case is indistinguishable from this. It was a press publication of the name of a rape victim in the face of an identical statute where the government had put the information in the public domain. The rationale of that decision, and as it has been applied in Smith and Landmark and Oklahoma Publishing, have not limited it to those circumstances. What the court recognized in Cox Broadcasting applies here. The point we've been discussing
well, there's a difference, isn't there? In Cox Broadcasting, the opinion of the court noted that in the developing common law tort of invasion of privacy, there was an exception for material that came to light during a judicial proceeding. These facts would not fall within that exception.
Your Honor, the it's court
a
talked
point made
about
of that in the opinion, as I remember.
The opinion noted a developing exception. There's also the same kind of privilege for accurately reporting government records, which this record
not,
was.
That's not what I'm addressing my remark to, as to whether you were covered like a blanket by the Cox case, and I don't think you are if you read the opinion.
Well, if you read the opinion together with the Smith versus Daily Mail case,
all right, maybe
the landmark case, you can see that Cox did not mean to restrict its ruling to information derived from the government records. Oklahoma Publishing, in characterizing Cox Broadcasting versus Cohn, talked of the Cox holding as pertaining to information placed on the public domain by government. If it pleases the Court, I'd reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Roddard. Mr. Eaton.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I want to divide my argument into essentially two parts, which you're free to interfere with, of course. But first, I think I need to distinguish Cox Broadcasting Corp. versus Cohn. And after I have done that, I will turn to how the conflicting interests, privacy versus free press, ought to be balanced, in our view, to resolve the question. Before I reach either of those subjects, however, I need to correct one thing that Mr. Roddard said. He said that the evidence in this case does not reflect that the assailant had not been apprehended at the time of the publication. The article in question here contains as its last sentence the following: patrol efforts have been suspended concerning this incident because of a lack of evidence. That article was in evidence at trial. BJF was asked at trial if that article was true, and she stated, unfortunately, it is true. So the fact that the assailant was still at large at the time of the publication is proven on the record in this case. When the gut issue here, privacy versus free press, came up to this Court, it was presented in a somewhat attenuated form in the Cox Broadcasting Corp. versus Cohn case. This Court never reached the point where it had to balance those conflicting interests, however, because with the exception of the Chief Justice's dissent on the jurisdictional ground, the Court unanimously concluded that because the rape victim's name in the Cox Broadcasting case had already been placed freely into the public domain in connection with a judicial proceeding, and nobody had ever taken any steps to protect the confidentiality of that information, and therefore the victim had no reasonable expectation of privacy at that point, that the newspaper could not be punished criminally or civilly for simply repeating in public what was already in the public domain. And because it reached that conclusion, it didn't have to go on to balance the respective interests involved. To the extent that there is any balancing suggested by Cox Broadcasting, I need to remind the Court as well that this is also a different factual case than Cox Broadcasting. In Cox Broadcasting, the victim was dead. Her mental and physical security did not need to be protected at that point. The plaintiff in Cox Broadcasting Corp., who was asserting a privacy right, was the victim's father. He was asserting his privacy right, not the victim, and the assailant had been apprehended. And the matter had reached full-blown judicial trial of this assailant, at which point a number of different considerations come into play than are involved in this case. Now, I argued below, and I have argued here, that the reason Cox Broadcasting does not control this case is, contrary to Mr. Roddard's suggestion to the Court, BJF's name was not in the, quote, public domain, close quote, at the time the newspaper obtained the information. Florida, perhaps in response to this Court's decision in Cox Broadcasting Corp., enacted a statute called the Florida Public Records Act, which contains an exemption. And it says that the identity of a rape victim on any public record maintained by the state of Florida is exempt from public disclosure. It is confidential.
It doesn't take it out of the public domain. I mean, something's in the public domain if it's public knowledge as opposed to something classified. That just means that the state won't release it. It doesn't take it out of the public domain. If the newspaper could go around and find out the name of that victim independently from a neighbor or from somebody else. I think you're confusing what's in the public domain with what is in public records. I think it has to be conceded that this was not properly in public records, but that isn't synonymous with being in the public domain.
Well, I'm not inclined to argue with Your Honor, except for the fact that the lower courts have declared as a matter of state law that this exemption from the Public Records Act attached to the material and not merely to the custodian. The argument below was that only the state has an obligation to follow this law, and the newspaper doesn't. Now, the state courts rejected that, and in the short opinion which is before the court, it has characterized this police report, which was stumbled on by this reporter trainee, as non-public information. And I think that conclusion is justifiable along the following line of reasoning. This report was not a press release. Mr. Roderick keeps calling it a press release. It was a copy of a police report form, the very document protected by the confidentiality laws of the state of Florida. One copy of that report was placed in a room labeled press room by mistake, obviously, without redaction of BJF's name. That report, so far as the record in this case reflects, was seen by no other person except the reporter trainee in this case. The reporter trainee testified at trial. Question, you understood you were not supposed to take down the information from the police department. Answer, yes. If she had followed what she knew to be the law and the policy of her own newspaper, it never would have gone any farther than a piece
Mr.
of paper.
Mr. Eaton, exactly what law was violated prior to publication of the name?
The Public Records Act exemption prevents the public disclosure of a rape victim's name contained on a police report.
Well, could the Florida Star have been prosecuted under Florida law if it had not published the name, but had taken, the trainee had taken the name down?
Not criminally, Your Honor.
Well, then I have a hard time understanding your argument that somehow the information was illegally obtained.
The argument is this, that there is a greater protection for the information on this piece of paper in the form of a state statute than there is in the judgment or the competence of a clerk at the desk in the police station.
But the statute makes it a crime to publish.
We're talking about two separate statutes here. There is a statutory scheme. There is an exemption to the Public Records Act, which makes the information on the police report confidential as a matter of state law. There is a second statute, which also prohibits an instrument of mass communication from reporting the name of a rape victim. I'm only talking now about the first statute, the exemption from the Public Records Act, in my effort to distinguish Cox.
Does the first statute subject the newspaper to prosecution because it found the name as it did?
No, Your Honor. And curiously, the criminal penalty that used to attach to the custodian of that information was recently removed by the Florida legislature, and even if a custodian turns that information over, he can't be prosecuted either. But the point of the law is,
you have to concede that the information was lawfully obtained by the Star.
I am unwilling to concede that, Your Honor.
Well, then can you cite the statute that was violated?
I refer, Your Honor, to the lower court's decision, which held that this was, because of the statute, non-public information. My argument is that the statute, which is a state law, which declares that piece of paper and that name confidential and not to be publicly disclosed, attaches to the material, which means that both the newspaper and the custodian of the document is bound to respect the state law. And the reason that that is important, and the reason why picking up this piece of paper with knowledge of the law, actual or imputed or otherwise, that this is a confidential document which you have come into possession of accidentally, the reason that is important is because when a rape victim who is now recovering and analyzing whether she dare go down to the police station or not to report this crime, and there is a serious problem of underreporting of rapes, wants to know whether she has any guarantee of anonymity, because if she knows, if she reports this crime the next day in the morning's newspaper, her name is going to be spread all over the city. She's not apt to go. She goes to the police station and she says, what guarantee do I have of anonymity? She is informed. The law of Florida is that your name on our records is confidential and that it can't be published.
To begin with, even if it were the law that the sheriff could not release her name, I don't know that if the sheriff did release it, the person to whom he released it would be violating the law. He might be in releasing it, but that doesn't mean that the person to whom he releases it is violating the law. Any more than if somebody comes over and hands me a classified document that he's not supposed to give me, and I look at it, I haven't violated the law.
I'm not suggesting, Your Honor, that the newspaper violated the Florida Public Records Act.
So then it received, it acquired the information legally as far as it was concerned.
I am suggesting to Your Honor, as the lower courts found as a matter of state law, that the information was non-public as a matter of law.
Well, let's talk about that. And, the statute you're talking about, you speak as though the statute prohibits the sheriff from releasing it. It doesn't. Section 1 says the sheriff shall permit all records to be given to the public. And then Section 3H says, however, information concerning sexual battery is not subject to that. That means he need not release it to the public. There is nothing in this section, 119.07, that prohibits it from him from releasing it to the public. It just says he need not, not that he must not.
I don't think Mr. Roderick would agree with Your Honor that that's a correct way to read it, because it is thoroughly settled in Florida law that that is a prohibition. And because it was never drawn into issue here, we haven't argued, and I haven't
got
given
cases on that, because it really doesn't read that way. Unless you're relying on some Florida cases that I don't know about, it clearly says every person who has custody shall permit the records to be inspected. And then 3H says, however, information on sexual battery is exempt from the provisions of subsection 1.
Well, Mr. Eaton, you might rely on one sentence in the District Court of Appeals opinion here, which says, reaching the merits, we find that the information published, the rape victim's name, was of a private nature and not to be published as a matter of law.
And they cite
an earlier.
And they go on in the last sentence to say, because this is non-public information. Rather than bring, Your Honor, all the cases, I would respectfully submit that the law of the case, in this case, with respect to the state law question of whether this information was public or non-public, is settled in favor of non-public information by virtue of the protection of that statute. Now, that does not answer the constitutional question here.
Of course, counsel, the statute that we're faced with, 794.03, goes much further. It prohibits the newspaper from publishing the information no matter where it gets it. Everybody in town can know it, and the only person that can't talk about it is the newspaper reporter.
There is a justification for that, as Your Honor observed initially, that the damage is done by mass circulation, not by this woman telling her physician or her boss or her mother. Those kind of things are not thought to be...
That would not be
restrained.
Quite a break with our precedents if we were to hold that, would it not?
Well,
I really know of no precedent, correct me if I'm wrong, which puts on the press a disability forbidding them from publishing something that it doesn't put on everybody else, i.e. divulging troopship information.
The problem is that this is not a suit brought on 794.03, and you're talking about an overbreath challenge which was really never raised below and which I need to come back to answer.
No, it's underbreath. It's quite the opposite.
An under-inclusiveness. That was never raised below in any form, and it therefore hasn't been briefed here. So the most that the briefs reflect is some footnotes way of observation.
Would you be willing to stipulate that we could affirm your judgment and still hold this statute unconstitutional?
I have argued that you must do that, because even if the statute is unconstitutional, we had a common law action for invasion of privacy and the only a negligence action, in effect, the only...
Oh, but this case was submitted to the jury on a negligence per se theory based on the statute.
In Florida, when you bring a negligence action and the legislature has enacted a statute which defines the minimum standard of care under a given circumstances, then if the evidence is uncontradicted, as it was in this case, that the defendant violated the statute, the law is that you have been negligent as a matter of law, and therefore the judge does not submit that question to the jury, and he directs a verdict in our favor. And that's what happened. But that is a finding by the judiciary of negligent conduct in this case. The only way the statute came into the case was as a minimum standard of care, a definition, a legislative definition of where your privacy rights are protected. And if you throw the statute out altogether, we still have a common law action for invasion of privacy without the benefit of the statute, in which we would have to prove that no reasonable person would have published this information, in which we had to prove reckless indifference, to get an award of punitive damages. But in this case, we proved reckless indifference. And we got an award of punitive damages. So we have a finding of fact from a jury on evidence which fully supports it, according to the state courts, that the newspaper was not merely negligent here, but was recklessly indifferent. And therefore, even if the statute itself is unconstitutional, our invasion of privacy action ought to survive on those findings of fact.
I suggest the trial judge would be very surprised by that result.
I borrowed that from the Chief Justice's opinion in Time Inc. versus Firestone, Your Honor, because there was a discussion in that opinion about if there is a finding of negligence or fault which would support the judgment. Even though it may have been reached for an unconstitutional reason, we're required to affirm the judgment.
Gee, there's really less to this case than meets the eye. I thought it was really a major constitutional issue here, but you're saying it's really just what the jury found is the only thing that's up, that no matter whether the statute's good or bad, this judgment stands?
Well, I think the major constitutional issue would exist in any of the 50 states which recognize a common law action for invasion of privacy in which the suit was brought against a newspaper or any instrument of the mass media for the publication of the name of a rape victim with or without the benefit of a statute.
Would those suits like this statute extend only to the press? I have heard the press come in and argue before me on many occasions for special privileges. This is the first case where I've been confronted with the opposite argument, that the press is at a disadvantage compared to everybody else in the world.
The reason why the statute makes perfect sense, to me at least, the way it's drawn, is that the tort of invasion of privacy, according to the restatement and the general formulation of it throughout the country, is that an invasion of privacy is actionable only if there has been widespread general publicity about an embarrassing private fact. Gossip over a backyard fence, telling one, two, or three, or four people, is not a tort of invasion of privacy. The tort itself requires widespread general publicity. So when you draft a statute which is designed to protect a privacy interest and support an invasion of privacy action, and which may have other perfectly good reasons behind it, what you want to prevent is widespread general publicity. And the way you do that is to address instruments of mass communication and leave out the gossip over the backyard fence and all of those kinds of things which would not be actionable in an invasion of privacy tort in the first place. So I don't think that this statute, by limiting itself to instruments of mass communication, because that's where the damage is it all consistent with the 50 to 80 years' worth of common law development of the tort of invasion of privacy.
For that reason, it makes sense. On the common law tort of invasion of privacy in Florida, are those cases are there such cases that do not rely on a statutory provision?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a common law provision, a common law tort, in which you must prove widespread general publicity about an embarrassing private fact.
You cite the Florida cases that define the tort in your brief?
I cited Kaysen versus Baskin, which is the leading Florida decision.
And there's no statute involved in that case?
There's no statute involved. That was the seminal decision in which Florida adopted and recognized the tort. There have been dozens of others since, but I didn't spend a lot of time arguing the common law to the court, so only Kaysen is cited to the court. To turn back a moment to whether or not this information was in the public domain, let me suggest to you that when this woman goes to police station and is assured a guarantee of anonymity if she reports the crime by virtue of the statutory provision which makes her name confidential on all the records and a statutory provision prohibiting publication of that name in an instrument of mass communication, her rights thereafter, when she reports the crime, ought to depend on the law, the statute. The public policy of the law of the state of Florida in the statute books and not upon the competence of some clerk in the police station. The First Amendment ought to turn, whether it covers this case or doesn't cover this case, on the law of Florida and not on the competence of a clerk in the police station. If it gets out that no matter what the law is, if you go down and report this crime, your name may end up in the newspaper the next morning and you're helpless to do anything about it if some clerk screwed up and put the paper on the desk, we got a serious problem. And I would suggest that you can analogize this argument that I'm making to distinguish Cox Broadcasting to your decision in Seattle Times versus Reinhardt. In that case, an action against a newspaper, the newspaper asked for discovery of information which the plaintiff said involved his privacy rights, and he was unwilling to give it up to the defendant because the defendant was a newspaper. And he therefore said, Judge, I need a protective order. I'll give them this material if you will prohibit them from publishing it. And the judge entered a protective order. Not a whole lot different than a clerk leaving this confidential report on the desk in the press room. A little different, but not a whole lot different for purposes of my analogy. This court affirmed that protective order on the ground that the privacy rights of this litigant were important enough to protect, notwithstanding that this was truthful information that had come into the hands of the press in a lawful manner through an act of a government employee, a judge, because the privacy rights were so important. And I would submit that the statutory scheme in Florida, i.e., as the lower courts have held as a matter of state law in this case, this information on this document is non-public, confidential, and the statute which says, and if it comes into your hands, you better not print it, are the same type of a protective order that was entered in Seattle Times.
Yes, but the you have to go on and say say that the interest in protecting this victim is so important that it overrides the interest of the press.
I agree with Your Honor. I am at the point where I was trying to distinguish Cox Broadcasting, okay. And obviously I need to turn to the remaining.
Well, you could have been, the same argument could have been made in Cox.
Well,
that the law just wherever you find this information, even in an open courtroom, it's just plain not public property.
I'm not the least bit ashamed to stand here and suggest to this court, notwithstanding that you were unanimous in Cox Broadcasting, that the name of a rape victim never ought to be in a newspaper. I don't care where they get it.
Yes,
it serves no purpose whatsoever. No,
but you do have to distinguish Cox, and you have done your best.
I have done my best. I will turn to the second issue.
Counsel, one question. Suppose a woman is arrested for murder, and it appears that 5 days earlier she had been the victim of a rape by the person she killed. Could the press publish that?
Not under this Florida statutory scheme. And I promised, Your Honor, I would come back to overbreadth, which I should very briefly, because I'm going to concede that as long as Cox Broadcasting Corp. is the law of the land, this 794.03, the one half of this statutory scheme that's an issue here, is overbroad. But the Florida courts have construed it to save it, and it ought to be saved in those cases where it can be applied. Now, there may be circumstances where a rape victim has no reasonable expectation of privacy that this statute could possibly implement, and that's clearly the case in his example with Senator Paula Hawkins, where she holds a press conference and announces this to the world. She has no reasonable expectation of privacy. No invasion of privacy action can lie. It would be absurd, and no Florida court would ever apply this prohibition against printing on those facts. Now, the overbreath challenge was raised only briefly below in a motion for directed verdict, which was abandoned when the post-judgment motions were abandoned by the filing of a notice of appeal. It was not argued in the appellant's initial brief below. The only thing I had to defend in the lower court was an as-applied challenge. Overbreath was mentioned in one paragraph in a reply brief. The Florida law is clear that the court won't consider an issue raised for the first time in a reply brief. And therefore, I think the issue before the court is whether this statutory scheme applied in the context of a common law invasion of privacy action is unconstitutional as applied and not overbroad. So I'm not prepared to concede to the court which cases fall in and which cases fall out. I do insist, however, that this case clearly falls at the core of the right of privacy and on the furthest fringes of the protections provided by the First Amendment. And to apply that statute, 794.03, to the facts in this case, once those conflicting interests are balanced, does not result in an unconstitutional impairment of the First Amendment. In my judgment, the First Amendment interest in this case is absolutely trivial, or at least negligible. This court has written over and over and over again, although it has not yet fully pinned down what the precise central meaning of the First Amendment is, it seems at least to be qualified by some notion that the First Amendment protects public discussion of public issues and matters of legitimate public concern and not matters about private people and their private concerns.
Haven't we also said, though, Mr. Eaton, that generally it's up to the publishers and editors of newspapers to decide whether something meets that standard rather than the government saying it?
No, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, in the Dun & Bradstreet versus Green Moss Builders Corporation, this very court said, and that was the issue in the case, is this a matter of public concern or is it not a matter of public concern? And I remember that the court was fractionated on the issue of whether the judiciary ought to be in that business. And it can be avoided in the defamation context by your private figure, public official, status-related tests. You can't, unfortunately, you can't avoid it in an invasion of privacy context, because if you're going to recognize the tort of invasion of privacy at all, it's going to take a bite out of the First Amendment. If the First Amendment is absolute and covers the publication of all truths, then there is no right of privacy, because there's no enforceable right of privacy. So how big a bite you allow to be taken, and whatever that size that bite is, there's going to be a line there between the First Amendment and the right of privacy. And I submit that the court, although it has not pinned the central meaning of the First Amendment down in the defamation context, ought to come out somewhere along those lines, a matter of legitimate public concern.
Mr. Eden, it's always a hard call as to how important the public interest is versus the interest of the press. And frankly, I have always thought that one of the disciplines that we impose upon the majority before they silence the press is that they have to be willing to silence themselves as well. You can't say the press won't talk about troop ships, but the rest of us can. If this is indeed that serious a concern, why shouldn't Florida's policy extend not just to the press but to anyone upsetting this woman or dishonoring this woman or anything else by circulating the fact that she has been the victim of a rape? Why is it just limited to the press? And why shouldn't we say, if you're really serious about this, if it is that serious an interest, you'd be willing to extend it to yourselves and not just pick on the media?
There are difficulties with that, Your Honor, which is what caused the common law of invasion of privacy to draw the line at massive general publicity rather than and exclude these other things. And the difficulties are that this woman obviously had to tell some people about her rape in this case. Her mother, who was taking care of her children, she had to tell her doctor, she had to tell the policeman. The policeman had to tell it to each other. There are many people who have to know about
this
thing.
Fine. They wouldn't be held liable for an invasion of privacy, obviously.
But
the backyard gossip who tells 50 people that don't have to know, why isn't she as just as much guilty of harming this woman as the press is?
50 people under Florida law, she probably is guilty of an invasion of privacy without the benefit of the statute.
Certainly doesn't cover it. The statute just reads the press, doesn't it?
The statute just addresses instruments of mass communication. Absolutely, Your Honor. The newspaper has conceded as much here by conceding on the record below that the journalism's code of ethics, its own policy, and the policy of most newspapers is that you don't print the name of a rape victim, because there is no legitimate public concern in that. And the simplest way to understand that there's no legitimate public concern in the name of that rape victim is to look at the article, omit the name, and see if the substance of that article changes in any way. I submit that it does not. This proceeding has proceeded all the way through this court. We're having oral arguments about some serious issues here today, and we have never mentioned this woman's name, and the fact that her name is not on the face of this proceeding does not detract from the substance of this proceeding in any way. There can be no legitimate public concern sufficient to override the serious interests that are at issue in this case, and those interests are the plaintiff's constitutional right of privacy, both in the federal constitution and the state constitution of the state of Florida, her statutory rights of privacy granted by the two statutes in issue here, her common law right of privacy, the state's interest in what Justice O'Connor alluded to when she talked about protecting the mental and physical security of the plaintiff. If you're the sole eyewitness to a rape and your assailant didn't know you before the rape, the last thing in the world you want to do is walk down the police station and have your name in the public, in the papers, the next day, because all that has to happen is the assailant looks you up in the phone book, finds out where you live, and eliminates you as the sole eyewitness to the crime. That is a very compelling interest that the state has to have in guaranteeing the anonymity of this victim, even at the expense of some negligible First Amendment rights. And I have also alluded to the fact that the state has a compelling interest in encouraging people to report crimes of rape, particularly rape crimes, because there's a serious underreporting of rape crimes crimes in this country. And on the compellingness of that interest, I would refer the Court to the Canadian Supreme Court's recent decision in Her Majesty the Queen versus Canadian Newspapers, in which the Supreme Court of Canada unanimously upheld, against a First Amendment or a Freedom of the Press challenge, a provision allowing a complainant, a rape victim, to get a court order from a judge prohibiting the publication of her name in instruments of mass communication.
Is that cited somewhere in your briefs?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
You probably have an Official Secrets Act up there, too. I don't know.
They have a First Amendment, which is very similar to ours, and they have written in their Bill of Rights a provision that says you can't modify these rights except where they're reasonable and justified in a free and democratic society, which is an expression of what this Court does in all these cases when it balances conflicting interests to decide whether one is more important than the other. And I would
we just
submit,
didn't need a constitutional provision to authorize it.
Thank you.
Mr. Roddert, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you. I'd like to first address briefly the question of whether this case is a common law action for invasion of privacy, and in answer to Justice Stevens' question, Cape Publications versus Bridges, cited at page 40 of our brief, adopts essentially the restatement of torts, section 652D, as to a common law action. If you compare the restatement with the amended complaint, which is in the appendix to the jurisdictional statement, starting at appendix page 7, you'll see that none of the elements of a common law cause of action for invasion of privacy are pleaded in this case. This is simply not an common law case. Finally, on that point, at the joint appendix on page 30 and footnote in our brief on page 6, the ruling of the judge on the plaintiff's motion for directed verdict demonstrates that the ruling in this case was based on 794.03, the mere act of publication created liability. There is none of the protective measures developed in the law of libel involving fault and protection of truth. On the proposition that the statute protects victims by prohibiting publication, in the words of this court in Boston Globe, that proves too much. There is no principled basis for limiting that type of analysis to rape victims. That would be true of all victims of all crimes which are unsolved, and a ruling, as Appley suggests, would severely inhibit the ability to report on crime, which, in Cox Broadcasting versus Cone, is a matter of public concern. Mr. Eaton talked about various distinctions in this case, the victim being dead, the assailant being at large. Those are not considerations under the statute. Those are not limiting factors under the statute. The statute is broad. It doesn't care whether the victim is dead or alive, whether the assailant is at large, whether the assailant has been convicted or acquitted, in fact.
Your opponent says that you, in effect, waived the overbreadth challenge in the court below.
Your Honor, we present the overbreadth challenge as a question under Cox Broadcasting, under Landmark, of a First Amendment question of whether there were less restrictive alternatives. It was also raised as overbreadth at the trial court and in the briefing in the First District Court of Appeal. But that the question of whether less restrictive alternatives exist, which is to say whether the statute goes beyond the bounds necessary for protecting First Amendment interests, is the federal question. The First and 14th Amendment question has been central throughout this case.
It's really a different question. It's not quite the same whether there's a less restrictive alternative. You could have an alternative that reaches the same speech and not other individuals that is less restrictive of that particular individual. I'm not sure that that's the same as overbreadth. That's all you're relying on.
The First Amendment analysis also questions whether First Amendment restrictions are effective to achieve their purposes. And that would be, an enlargement of the First Amendment argument would be to the effect that this statute, because it doesn't restrict other publications, it is confined to press publications is not effective in achieving the purpose, whatever that purpose is. We don't have a record of it. It hasn't been stated by the state of Florida. The state of Florida isn't here today. I would like to make one point clear from my previous argument. We had a colloquy about truth as a defense, and I want to make it quite clear that that is an alternative basis for a ruling in this case. I would suggest that this decision is due to be reversed on the most limited grounds set forth in Cox, that the First and 14th Amendment do not permit sanctions for truthful publication of information lawfully obtained from the public record. I agree with Justice Scalia's analysis that Chapter 119 of the Florida statutes creates a broad definition of public records.
Your time has expired, Mr. Rotter. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.